Time once again for Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat This State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's slap your hands before we went
down. Proof once again that we don't just start talking when the mic's gone.
That's right.
Well, actually, we do just start talking when the mics come on. But
unfortunately.
It's not like in TV where you got the little red lights that come on the camera so you know when you're live.
Exactly.
So
good morning to you.
Good morning. So we got a lot to cover today. So let's just dive into it and no more chit-chat. Week and a half back, local activist Bert Sachs came down with a heart attack.
Yeah, wanted to just give a good shout out and get better. He seems to be doing well and up and around, but it was a fairly serious heart attack. Bert Sachs, for folks who kind of recognize the name but can't quite sure what to place it, has been to Iraq a number of times, is really done an amazing job over the past number of years of sort of sounding the alarm over the impact of sanctions, and then, of course, more recently, the proposed U.S. invasion and then the invasion. So he, unfortunately, has been doing that full time. He's an older gentleman in his early 60s, I think, and so does not have any medical insurance to cover his medical costs. And so look in the next few weeks for a public event to try and raise money to help Bert with his medical costs, because he's done an awful lot for the people of Iraq and the people of Seattle. So we want to give him some of that love back, and in the meantime, get well, Bert.
Yeah, there's a certain irony there with all the money for medical supplies that he has helped raise and take over to Iraq. You know that now we got to give a little bit of that back.
Well,
back
not
to Bert.
Not to mention that you have much better chance of getting free medical care in Iraq than you do in the United States.
That's just how twisted things are. Well, speaking of Iraq, a very busy week there.
It's been a very busy week in Iraq. I'm just going to go over the guerrilla tally. There was the 13th suicide car bombing in Iraq this week on Wednesday in Nasiriyah, which killed 32 people. 18 of them were Italian folks, most of those military police, a couple of soldiers, and a couple of civilians. It wounded more than 80 people. There have been almost nightly mortar attacks in Baghdad, and on Wednesday, the day of the bombing in Nasiriyah, and the day that the U.S. began its supposed operation to stop these guerrilla attacks, the U.S. troops came under 47 separate attacks across Iraq.
New daily record.
That are known, yeah. There may have been more that were not reported by the Coalition Provisional Authority. Now, the U.S. troop tally, the number of people that the U.S. troops have killed or taken pot shots at this week, is pretty high as well. Six people were killed in an attack by U.S. troops on a hospital in Fallujah. The hospital is run by the Jordanian government. There was no explanation given as to why U.S. troops would attack a hospital. That was also on Wednesday night, the night of the bombing in Nasiriyah. U.S. troops in Baghdad fired on a car carrying a member of the Iraqi Governing Council. It was carrying one of the two Shiite Muslim clerics that sits on the council. Not exactly good for our main allies in Iraq.
And also notable in that were it not for who had been in the car, that probably would not have even been reported, because
That's right.
Firing on those types of vehicles has become so common in many of the cities of Iraq.
That's right. And then earlier in the week, on Monday, a U.S. guard shot and killed the U.S.-backed mayor of Sadr City, which is the largest Shiite suburb of Baghdad, shot and killed this man who was appointed by the U.S. Coalition Provisional Authority to be the mayor of that section of Baghdad. The man was actually just trying to get into his office when a guard who probably did not speak Arabic just fired a warning shot, ended up shooting him in the legs, and he bled to death. On Wednesday evening, after the car bombing in Nasiriyah, U.S. troops went to the south of Baghdad, and they did part of a preemptive strike against a textile factory. U.S. troops and an AC-130 gunship strafed and tried to bomb the textile factory. Although the Coalition Provisional Authority claimed that the building had been destroyed and that it was housing guerrillas and weapons who were engaging in attacks on U.S. troops, A New York Times reporter actually visited the site and saw only textile machinery and noted that when U.S. troops were there, they didn't detain anyone, not even the owner of the factory, and they did not find any weapons on the site. Now, this little fiasco is part of a larger operation called Operation Iron Hammer, supposedly an effort to preemptively strike at guerrilla fighters before they attack U.S. forces and Iraqi civilians. However, a senior official in the Coalition Provisional Authority told the Washington Post this week, quote, "I don't know that this will impress anyone very much. Maybe it will be good for troops' morale." Now, it doesn't help when you shoot up a factory that's full of textile machinery as opposed to guerrilla fighters. What this is going to do for Iraqis is just another matter. Thomas Mokaitis, who's a historian and editor of a book called Grand Strategy in the War Against Terrorism, told the San Francisco Chronicle this week, quote, "We're doing the same thing wrong that we did all the way back in Vietnam, which is to fall back on the use of force. The Viet Cong used to call B-52 raids recruiting drives." Now, on Monday, the Bush administration had received a report from the CIA station chief in Iraq. Now, parts of that report were leaked to the press. In summary, it said that the security situation in Iraq is going to get worse, that it's not going to improve, it's going to get worse, and that more ordinary Iraqis are starting to support the guerrillas. Now, the report went into a little bit of detail about why that is. One of the main reasons for why ordinary Iraqis are supporting the guerrillas is because of the fact that they're being targeted by U.S. troops who don't have good intelligence about where the guerrillas are, where they're hiding,
even who they are.
And even who they are. Another of the main reasons for this is that the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council has been an outright failure so far. Now, why it's been a failure is pretty clear. The major factions are not getting along because the council is made up of Shiites, Sunnis, Kurds, exiles, etc. Many of the prominent members don't even attend the meetings regularly. And by prominent members, I mean mostly the exiles, the ones who have some power on the council, who speak English as well as Arabic, and who stepped in immediately when the council was formed and took over the major positions. Now, also, too many of the members have spent most of their time traveling abroad, and they're not overseeing the newly appointed cabinet ministers. So the cabinet ministers in the coalition, or the governing council body, are not even a they not only don't have access to funds to do their job, they don't even really know what their job is supposed to be if the governing council is not giving them any kind of direction.
And in many cases, they don't even have offices and staffs to go along with their titles.
That's right, and they're having
a hard time with security after all these months. Yeah,
they're having a hard time with security as well. Now, in addition to this, the council's most effective and experienced member was assassinated. Akilah al-Hashimi, if folks will remember when we were here and actually talked about who was sitting on the governing council, she was one of only two people on the council who had any diplomatic experience at all, and she was the more experienced of the two. The other person, Adnan Pachachi, he is I believe in his 80s, and his last diplomatic experience was way back in the 1960s, and so he's a bit out of practice. Akilah al-Hashimi had actually been a member of the Ba'ath Party and had been a diplomat in Saddam Hussein's government. She had some experience. She is now dead. She was shot by Iraqi guerrillas some weeks ago. And since then, what you've had is these Iraqi exiles grandstanding, traveling around, using their time for things other than council business. The council can't agree on how to draft a constitution or on when or even if elections should be held. Some members, including Ahmed Chalabi, want the U.S. to just cede all authority to the governing council itself and let their party militias take control of security in Iraq. Now, this is, as we talked about last week and the week before, would probably lead to civil war when you have these already factional infighting on the governing council. It would be much worse if we ceded all authority to the governing council and let these factions start to try to parcel out sections of Iraq and piece out who's going to control what.
Particularly when you have people like Chalabi who've already demonstrated in terms of who's getting jobs, in terms of where the contracts are going for reconstruction, that they're incredibly corrupt as well
That's
as being willing to misuse those kind of security forces.
Yeah, and that's what most of these folks have been doing with their time on the council. They have not been doing council business. They've been using their influence as council members to get subcontracts from the major U.S. corporations who are doing the reconstruction work in Iraq. They've been getting these subcontracts for their own businesses and for the businesses of their friends, for returning exiles who are not, in fact, employing native Iraqis who are out of a job. They are actually, in a lot of cases, employing other returning exiles or cheaper Southeast Asian labor, which is insane given that the high unemployment rate in Iraq is part of the reason why there's a guerrilla war going on right now.
And it sounds like what's happening in Washington.
Well, I was going to say it sounds a lot like it's happening in the West Bank and Gaza, where one of the reasons for the Intifada is that nobody has a job or nobody can get to their job, and so people have all this time on their hands, and so they wind up going to the political funerals and participating in the resistance.
Yes, exactly. That's the dynamic that's going on in Iraq right now. Now, there were rumors this week that the U.S. would actually scrap the governing council since it has not done anything, not even come up with the timeline that it's required. It's required by U.N. resolution to come up with a timeline by December 15th of when elections will be held, when the constitution will be drafted, etc. And they have not been able to agree or even get together because many members of the council are not even attending meetings to make any kind of decision on this. So there was a rumor that the U.S. would actually scrap the governing council. And Paul Bremer was recalled to Washington, D.C. on very short notice for 2 days of really intense talks with the Bush administration on how to get the governing council going or what to replace it with or how to just get, you know, some kind of a government to turn things over to in Iraq. And we don't really know what the outcome of those talks have been. The Bush administration's been very tight-lipped about it. And Paul Bremer has not told anybody. He's going to spend the next few days sitting in conference with Iraqi governing council members to try to come up with something. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, and one of the things that happened in Washington, D.C. this week was you had the Bush administration really reversing itself and saying, you know, we want to turn things over to the Iraqis and get the heck out of there as quickly as we can, as opposed to, you know, 2 weeks ago, Bush was talking about staying the course and we don't run and all of this. Somebody suddenly, I don't know if it was the leaked CIA report or there was some sort of a reality check that seems to have suddenly happened.
Yeah, I think it had to do with the increased violence in the last 2 weeks and the fact that Bush's popularity has dropped precipitously in the polls.
Yeah,
along
going
with
into
that.
An election year.
Yeah, I think it was the Bush reelection campaign that called for the change in strategy.
Yeah.
I mean, you may be joking, but I think there's a lot of truth to that, actually.
I think so.
That is very much a political calculation.
Mm-hmm. Now, just a couple of other really quick things on Iraq. The U.S. has been trying to get troops from other countries in. The main prospects were South Korea, Turkey, and Japan. South Korea looked like it was a done deal. The U.S. thought, oh, we'll get 10,000 or more troops from South Korea. Well, this past week, after seeing all of the violence in Iraq these last couple weeks, the South Korean government said, no, the maximum we will send is 3,000 troops and not on the timeline that you're expecting. We're going to send them in slowly, hoping that the security situation will improve. Turkey this week finally gave up and said, we're not sending anybody. You guys have dropped the ball on this. You didn't check with the Kurds in Iraq, and we're not sticking our finger into that pot and stirring it up. So no troops from Turkey. And then Japan, Donald Rumsfeld is over there right now trying to get them to send troops. On the day before he arrived in Japan to talk to the Japanese prime minister, the Japanese prime minister announced, well, we're not sending anybody because the security situation is bad. We're going to wait for things to improve, which I think is a real direct slap in the face for Donald Rumsfeld. Even before he set foot in Japan, they said, sorry, if you come here expecting us to give you anything, you're not getting anything.
Well, if anybody knows anything about the Japanese politeness or that culture to begin with, and let alone how it's done in the diplomatic circles, it was a very much a direct slap in the face. And sending somebody like Rumsfeld over there to browbeat the Japanese is one of the most counterproductive things you can do. That's
exactly
the last personality type you want doing diplomatic negotiations with any Asian culture, really. really.
That's very true. And then finally, I want to just report that the Wall Street Journal had an interesting article this week. I believe it was on Thursday. They reported that oil technicians in northern Iraq are now pumping 300,000 barrels per day of oil back into the ground. Now, I'm going to repeat that. They're pumping 300,000 barrels of oil per day back into the ground because there's no place else to put it. Now, why that is, they've filled up all of the storage tanks that they have in the northern oil fields of Iraq, and the northern export pipeline to Turkey is still down. It's been attacked and sabotaged 14 times since June. The latest one was 2 weeks ago, and they still haven't repaired it. And as Jav said to me this morning, once they get it operating again, it's going to be attacked again. So that's
and
just
again,
a,
and again, and again,
and again, and again. Yeah. And again. Yes, and so I think we can pretty much say that any hopes that oil revenue will help to pay for reconstruction is a bit of a joke at this point.
Yeah, and one of the things about the countries withdrawing on their troop commitments is not just a question of they're having concerns about the deteriorating security situation. It's also a statement that they have concerns about the Americans' ability to deal with the deteriorating security situation and the sense that things are going to get worse before they get better. The same sort of thing the CIA report was saying.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like perhaps that Operation Iron Hammer might be pounding the final nail into the coffin.
Yes, it might.
And right. The question is, who's in the coffin?
Yeah. Yeah. All right, moving along. We have a worldwide event coming up the end of this next week. The FTAA is on a lot of people's radar.
Yeah, actually, there's a couple of them in the Southeast that I want to talk about, and one of which will also have a corollary event in Tacoma tomorrow. You have in the Fort Benning, Georgia, the School of the Americas annual protest that is happening next weekend, and then between now and then, and the particular days of the 19th to the 21st, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, in Miami, the Free Trade Area of the Americas negotiating session will be held. This is the same free trade pact that inspired such protests in Quebec City and also in several cities in South America when it's been held in those cities in recent years. There are a number of interesting sort of symbolic dynamics that are fascinating to having those particular negotiating meetings in Miami. Of course, Miami being the port of choice for every exiled kleptocrat and dictator in Latin America once they're dethroned. You know, everyone from the Batista supporters, America's favorite terrorists, who still live there, to the exiled president of Bolivia, who when he fled his country last month, got on a commercial flight to Miami. It really is where many of them go, and you know, for generations now, really much of the income of South Florida or wealth of South Florida has been partially generated by the wealth stolen from places to the south. But so you've got that coming. You've got the tremendous momentum of pro-democracy, anti-globalization forces all across Latin America that have been winning in country after country in recent years, and particularly in the last couple of years in Bolivia, in Brazil, Peru and Ecuador and Venezuela, the collapse of the Argentina, the collapse of the WTO talks in Cancun, which was led by Brazil and other Latin American countries. So there's and the collapse of the WTO in Cancun is very much going to be on the mind of the negotiators in Miami, because the bilateral and multilateral trade pacts, like the Free Trade of the Area of the Americas, is Washington's chosen strategy right now for implementing free trade, implementing neoliberalism, giving American-based multinational corporations the ability to extract resources and use the cheap labor from countries in parts of the world that don't have the labor costs that we have here. The WTO was supposed to be set up for that. The WTO is stymied right now, and so Washington is hoping that it can do in bits and pieces, country by country, region by region, what it has been unable to do worldwide. So you have that, and you have protesters descending from all across Latin America as well as all across North America. And the security for Miami, and of course Seattle, is once again being ritually invoked, as it often is in these situations. You have $8.5 million that was appropriated in the $87 billion for Iraq was appropriated for to help reimburse for security costs for Miami. Now, you know, maybe economically there's some direct link there between what the FTA represents and what U.S. costs in Iraq represent, but it's a pretty indirect link. But you have that kind of money going in, that kind of attention from the feds. At the same time, the Miami Police Department announced this week that journalists wanting to cover the protests and what's going on outside the talks will be embedded in police units in Miami, which is a little trick that they picked up from the U.S. military.
It's to keep them from being embedded in the protests, I believe.
Yes, exactly. And
which
also
might be the
to,
natural place for them to go get the viewpoint of protesters.
Well, and also it's a clear statement that they view protesters not as American citizens or ordinary people who have concern, but as the, you know, unspeaking criminal, the enemy. I mean, it's the military enemy. It's the, you know, the dark opposition of all that is good and right about America. And it really is setting itself up as a fairly ugly dynamic. So we want to keep an eye on that in the coming week. And then at the same time, it may be a whirlwind activist tour for some people going down to that part of the country, because we have the protests which have been going on this time of year for several years now in Fort Benning, Georgia, around the School of the Americas, which once we have tried to take away the democratic right of countries to the south of here to determine their own economic policies, the other strategy that has been used time and again by the United States is to train strongmen to send down there to try and enforce Washington's will for us. And that has certainly been part of the dynamic that's been happening with Colombia, which has been in the news of late. But there's a long, long history through the School of the Americas of people being trained who have been trained there and have gone through the Army's program there, who then have been linked with some of the worst human rights abuses of the last several decades in Latin America. So that is going on next week. There is also, as I mentioned, a corollary protest that is not just for Seattle and Tacoma, but for people all across the Pacific Northwest and basically San Francisco North, that will be held in Portland Avenue Park, East 35th and Portland Avenue in Tacoma. It'll be all day tomorrow. There'll be march and rally. I believe it starts at 10 o'clock in the morning.
And they're calling for the closure of the School of the Americas.
Yes, which they came within about 10 votes of doing that in the year 2000.
In Congress.
And then the alternative version of the bill, which was passed and said, simply renamed it. But the training program and the curriculum in that program by almost all accounts have pretty much stayed intact. The changes were unfortunately strictly cosmetic so far.
Okay. Well, and finally, this week, there's further news about Boeing and its 787.
Yes, speaking of the export of jobs.
Yes, indeed. Now, folks might not know this, or they may know this. I'd be surprised if many folks didn't know this, but most of the wings for Boeing's airplanes are built here in the Puget Sound. I think the only exception is the 717, the little jet. Those wings are not built here in the Puget Sound. But it was leaked this week that Boeing is going to send the wing work for the new 77 jet over to Japan, along with the major portion of the fuselage work. Now, this is a blow to Boeing's machinists and engineering unions, who had hoped that the wing work would stay here in the Puget Sound area. The reason that's given for sending that wing work over to Japan is because Boeing needs those Japanese customers to buy the airplane. Now, you have to understand that nobody, in spite of the Boeing hard sell that they've given to airliners, nobody has stepped forward and said that they wanted to be the first customer to buy the 787. Nobody has come forward and placed an order yet. Now, that means the loss shipping that wing work over to Japan would mean the loss of about 1,000 workers here. And you can add that to the several thousand workers that have already been laid off this year from Boeing plants. Now, it's kind of interesting because...
And the money that we gave Boeing anyway in order to attract those jobs.
Yeah, now it's kind of interesting. You can go to the PI website, and I believe they still have this little diagram up there. The Post Intelligencer has this little diagram of what portions of the 787 will be built where. And if you look at the airplane, you notice that the majority of it will be built overseas in Japan. And the only piece that will be built here in the Pacific Northwest is the tail fin, that little piece that sticks up in the very back part of the plane that is, oh, I don't know what, about 1/20th of the whole airplane. Now, in addition to this, folks should remember that early in the year when the legislature met, they discussed giving Boeing a big tax break in order to keep them here and to get some of that construction work on the 787, and in the hopes that Boeing would assemble the 787 here in the Pacific Northwest.
Now, and even with the great budget shortfall is one of Gary Locke's biggest priorities. He really pushed that.
That's right. It was passed in the legislature to give Boeing this enormous tax cut that amounted to some tens of millions of dollars to hopefully attract that work here. Now, as we can see, Boeing is not going to actually bring as much of the work here as the legislature assumed. Boeing still hasn't made the decision as to where the plane is going to be assembled, and it's hoped that it'll be assembled someplace here in the Pacific Northwest. However, with our roads and our rail and our problems with transportation, I don't think we can count on that.
And as Mike actually mentioned before we went on the air, with the vast number of different states and localities that essentially gave Boeing tax cuts to try and sweeten the pot and lure this project to their particular places, in many of those cases, if not most of them, those tax breaks and those other gifts to Boeing took effect regardless of whether or not they actually got the final work. So Boeing's making an enormous amount of money off of this bidding process without giving the goods to most of the places that have offered them.
From states all over.
Right, and all these municipalities are now out of this potential funding, this money that would be coming in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in almost all those cases, they're also facing budget shortfalls. That's also a
nearly all of these cases.
Yeah.
Yes, that's very true.
So it'd be interesting if somebody could research that and tally all that up, because I somehow think that is a larger column idea.
I'm going to pitch that next week for the weekly. That is something I want to do. It's a good idea. Thank you.
Okay. Well, with that, we still got 2 minutes talking this week, as usual. I can't believe that. But it's okay. It's okay if we actually end on time. But
I want to also remind folks, too, that the City Council is still undergoing the budget process, and they've restored several of the things that Mayor Greg Nichols had cut out of the revised budget. And they have voted it out of committee, and it is now the new budget that they have revised is now before the whole council. And if folks are interested, you should probably hop on the City Council website, check it out, go to a City Council meeting, and give your input.
Yeah,
and now that you can do it in open City Council meetings.
Yes, and also Tuesday night, the monorail hearings are going to be happening, an all-city consultation on where the station should go and all that sort of information.
Oh, because there's, I know also Tuesday night, the 18th, there's also a meeting about police accountability at I think 5:30. So
plenty of things for people to do if you're looking for some way to raise heck.
Go down, check out the new City Hall. There's plenty of seats for everybody. All right. With that, we are out of time. Talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And tell people, where do you find Eat the State?
Comes out every other week, including this coming week. Free newspaper that you can find wherever you find free newspapers, bookstores, cafes, restaurants, places where they just have big wads of dead trees sitting by the window or the door. You can also find it on the web, www.eatthestate, all one word, .org. You can also subscribe through the mail or send us donations, P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington, 98145. And if you missed any of that, if you'd like to volunteer, if you have story ideas, comments, give our voicemail a ring and leave a message and we'll call you back. It's area code 206-903-9461.